The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
From WABE in Atlanta, this is Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up on today's program, a new partnership between the Henry County Sheriff's Office and the Morehouse School of Medicine will offer resources to those reentering society after incarceration, and it includes a new restorative center in McDonough. Plus, understanding the purpose of Georgia's Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund and why there is opposition to some bills that could risk the safety net for the state's unemployed. All that's just ahead, but first, a check of these headlines, and we begin, of course, with news from the state capitol. It's unlawful in 23 states to leave firearms where they can be assessed by children. Georgia is not one of them. But one lawmaker is working to change that, as we hear from WABE politics reporter Sam Greenglass.
It's exceedingly rare for a gun safety bill to even get a hearing in Georgia's Republican-dominated legislature. So when Democratic Representative Michelle Au got her bill in front of a committee, it was a big deal.
In 2020, firearms became the number one cause of death for children and teenagers in the United States. And that's a statistic that really deserves not just notice, but action. We also know that when youth use firearms to commit violence against themselves or others, they almost always get these guns from their home or the homes of relatives or friends.
Under Au's bill, if a child accidentally gets hold of a loaded firearm, the person who negligently left it accessible could be charged with a misdemeanor. The bill didn't get a vote and is very unlikely to pass this year. Sam Greenglass, WABE News.
In other legislative news, it's back. Online sports betting legislation is on the move again inside the state capitol, this after it had actually stalled earlier in the session. The version that passed out of a state Senate committee yesterday would not require approval from Georgia voters. The version of the bill doesn't include casino gambling or horse racing. Republican State Senator Mike Dugan blasted the handling of the legislation, which was added to a bill, hold on to this, concerning soap box derbies.
Whoever came up with this idea just set sports betting back 5 years. When you hijack a soapbox derby and put sports betting on the back of it, every person that was on the fence in the state of Georgia has just now picked a side of the fence.
Now, the soapbox derby bill was Republican Representative Lisa Higgins, and she too expressed disdain for the maneuvering to tack on the sports betting legislation.
It's my bill. It's my first bill. I'm a new legislator. This is important to me. But if this committee decides they'd rather have sports betting, then I would respectfully request that you would remove my language from it.
Okay.
So now there's no longer a soapbox derby bill. It's basically now an online sports betting bill. Committee Chair Brandon Breach specifically thanked Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones for bringing House Bill 237 back, which is now waiting to be scheduled for a state Senate vote. Representative Hagan only thanked the senator who voted against the new bill. Another report, black children with COVID-19 were more likely to be severely ill or hospitalized or even die during the pandemic than white children. And that's according to a new study from Morehouse School of Medicine. Jess Mador has more.
Morehouse School of Medicine researchers conducted the study with a group including other historically black medical schools. They looked at the pandemic between April 2020 and June of 2021, and they found black children were more than 2.5 times as likely to lose a parent to the virus compared to white children, and more likely to live in a home experiencing pandemic-driven economic hardships. The disparities were linked in part to inequalities that existed before the pandemic, poverty and obstacles in accessing medical care, for example. To help close the gaps, researchers are calling for policy changes, including expanding access to child health insurance programs. Jess Mador, WABE News.
And a programming note, Closer Look will address this during one of our segments next week. And finally, in keeping with our Closer Look St. Patrick's Day tradition that started last year when producer Daniel Raziel came aboard, we present Irish Disco, yes, mashed up with the classic Heart of Glass by punk group Blondie. Apparently, they sound alike. You all be the judge. That's just off. They do not sound alike. This is Closer Look. We're back in a moment.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
And Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. According to the most up-to-date data from the Georgia Department of Corrections, the state's recidivism rate among individuals released from prison is about 30%. However, GDC's calculation does not include offenders who commit technical violations while they are on parole, nor does it take into account offenders who recidivate after 3 years. So there's been some pushback regarding this statistic. Now, we have to include these additional factors, so the recidivism rate sits closer maybe to 50%, and that's from the Georgia Center for Opportunity. Well, now comes the Morehouse School of Medicine and the Henry County Sheriff's Office, because they're partnering to provide tools and resources for those formerly incarcerated. It's a step in the right direction, Pathway Forward Reentry Program. So I want to welcome in Dr. Angelita Howard, the founding assistant dean of the online education and expanded programs at Morehouse School of Medicine, and Tamarlin T. Carter, the director of the Henry County Sheriff's Office Restorative Center. Dr. Howard, Director Carter, thank you for taking time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
We have a lot to talk through, but first I just want to, you know, Georgia for a few years under former governor Nathan Deal, there was a lot of praise about, you know, what was considered a positive and a more, I guess, progressive approach in terms of criminal justice reform. Georgia had been spending a lot of money, up in the billions, on its correctional facilities and on that end. And so there was a lot that went into under Governor Deal's administration into changing that. When you reflect now, are you seeing some, is it going backwards? Is it moving forward? Do you have some concerns overall about how Georgia's criminal justice reform system is working now? Do you have some concerns? And I'll start with you, Dr. Howard.
So thank you again for allowing us to be here. Absolutely. I continue to have the concerns about what we're doing in the system, how we're working through the system, and seeing marginalized populations to continue to be impacted. And so I'm so happy with our partnership with Henry County, what we're doing to really change those trajectories, make sure that when individuals, when they go in, they'll come back out and never return. Mm-hmm. It appears that not only Georgia, but all states in the U.S., it's a weapon. It is used as a weapon against, and it's impacting more Black and Brown young men. And so we have to do something. We absolutely must do something to change their pathways, to change where they're going once they leave, and really before they even get there. So looking at elementary, looking at middle school and doing programs in Director Carter will get into that, what the Henry County is doing, what his programs are doing to really impact those so that we can get a hold of those individuals before they're impacted by the justice system.
Director Carter, your thoughts on this whole process of you know, what needs to happen, not only before we get to talking about folks reentering, but even prevention. More resources are needed. I'm assuming that's what you agree with.
Absolutely. Let me say thank you, Ms. Rose, for having us. I think this is extremely important that we continue to champion and share the message. Before we get to recidivism, we must start at the home of individuals. When there is a crack in a home, then it leads down the road of these places. I am excited to say that we understand that at the Henry County Sheriff's Office, where Reginald Scandrett, he is putting measures in place prior to individuals coming in contact with the justice system. We just recently launched what is called S3, setting students up for success. And what we realize in that is if a kid leaves a home that's disturbed or troubled, it's difficult for him to learn when he shows up at school. One presenter puts it in the manner that we must go from consequences to conversations. And when individuals cannot have healthy conversations about their environment, then we will find ourselves in these spaces. And when it comes to reducing recidivism, we must understand even in that work, it's all about the environment. Mm-hmm. If the environment is not conducive for growth, regardless of who you are, you'll find yourselves in the opposite direction. Otherwise, you'll ultimately end up in a deficit. So when it comes to reducing recidivism, it starts way before an individual finds themselves in the justice system. But it's easier in many cases, and this is the sad part, especially in the work that we're finding now, that they can access programs easier on the inside of a facility than they can access programs outside of a facility.
What does that say to you then, Director Carter?
What that says to me is that we're giving so much attention on what's happening on the back end versus saying, what are we doing as preventive measures? When I hear participants in a restorative center say, I want to stay here until I complete a program, that disturbs me when they're asking not for less time inside of a facility, but more time inside of a facility, because we are bringing an amazing approach mm-hmm. to the restorative center.
And so, Dr. Howard, for someone listening, look, the bottom line is that let's make sure we have resources so folks don't have to even enter the system. But if
go ahead. No, absolutely. And I wanted to speak to what Director Carter stated. We have individuals, even from a healthcare perspective, who have started dental work or who started some type of work while they were incarcerated. They will reoffend to go back because they don't have the resources. They don't have dental insurance, or they don't have the necessary health insurance to get the help that they were getting while they were incarcerated. And so that has to be a change within our system, that they will receive the help. There is a new law. There was a new law. As a matter of fact, I hate to even say it, but Donald Trump tried to pass a portion of it. Then it went to our governor, who passed some type of law where individuals and it continues to change will receive, let's say, $200 in food stamps for 3 months once they are released. Well, it takes more than 3 months sometimes to get on your feet. Mm-hmm. It takes longer than that, depending on why you were incarcerated, depending on the resources or the help that you need afterwards to get back on your feet. So having $200, especially in an economy like this, where eggs are $12 a carton mm-hmm. or a pack, $200 doesn't speak a lot, especially for 2 or 3 months for people to get back on their feet. So resources before and after are absolutely necessary.
So we're talking about then added layered barriers that one might face when they're trying to reenter. And depending on what the charge was or the offense, you know, there are some jobs that they may not be eligible to apply for, or just even knowing where to go to apply for help. I want to move to then what you all are coming up with, and that's this partnership. It's called A Step in the Right Direction, Pathway Forward Reentry Program. How did all this come about, Dr. Howard?
So I met Director Carter a few years ago. We actually met at church. And so we've cultivated an amazing relationship. And so his heart certainly speaks to this. At Morehouse School of Medicine, we developed in partnership with WellPath about a year and a half ago, this work around reducing recidivism, a life coach program and a master of administration in justice involved care. We have the certificate and the master's. And so with my connection with Director Carter and his heart to really move through, and I know he'll talk about his work at the Henry County Sheriff's Office. We sat at, I believe, the Mellow Mushroom. We always find these places to sit and eat and come up with and brainstorm ideas. But we sat together and started really talking about how do we reduce recidivism? Mm-hmm. How do we impact this community? How do we do this? And so with the work that we're doing at Morehouse School of Medicine, coupled with what he's doing at the Henry County Sheriff's Office, this was really a step in the right direction. Mm-hmm. And that really was to take citizens, as we call them, our brothers, our friends, who had about 160 days or less in jail and really put them through this reentry program.
So, Director Carter, you all are focusing on those individuals who are 160 days out from reentering. So you're starting that far ahead.
Absolutely. Because it does take a period of time in order to get an individual acclimated to being restored or returning to their general community. We don't refer to, in the grand scheme of things, a dorm or a cell. We refer to those common spaces as a community. And in those communities, we ensure four major areas in our approach: educational enhancements and enrichments, technical life skills, as well as personal and self-care. Mm-hmm. When we say that, we must understand that individuals have successfully completed welding programs. They've successfully completed Lean Sigma 6, OSHA 10. We're bringing entrepreneurship, business plan development. There's an array of things, but you cannot do that without coupling that with life skills and the pathway forward, which is a part of the reentry toolkit. You have individuals that are not aware of how powerful a birth certificate on hand is or a Social Security card is. And we have to help them understand those things because times are changing and they're changing swiftly. Mm-hmm. Some individuals have showed up in the facility and it has been a year or it has been 2 years. And in that case, nothing has remained the same. Mm-hmm. So when you're acclimating an individual back to community, you have to think housing market has changed. There are so many barriers that are against them until it's really helping not only the individual shift, but also the family members that's going to be receiving them to shift.
Now, there's a restorative center that is in McDonough. So will those individuals, will they attend this restorative center during the day or will they be, how is this going to work?
So that's a great question. So let me tell you, Chef Reginald Scandrez, he has a top six, and his number one is reducing recidivism. Mm-hmm. There was a jail facility that was out. It was called the Annex for a period of time that no one was really utilizing in the moment. And so we were able to remodel that space for this work. So we actually have individuals that are there in that space whenever they have been classified by a certain classification, and they're in that 160 marker. We're now at cohort four in the group of individuals that have come to our facility. And we're working with the court systems. We're working with Morehouse, Southern Crescent, Atlanta Regional Commission. There are a number of silent partners that's doing the work.
And so, Dr. Howard, what role will Morehouse School of Medicine play in all this?
So I want to go back to what Director Carter stated, because for those of us, or for those of you who are listening, I don't think he really gave a picture of what the facility looks like, the Annex, the Restorative Center. It is classic. It is state of the art. The work, the love, the amount of attention that was put into that space, I really haven't seen anything like that. And it's done in such a way that I believe it does create this community. It does create the what happens when I leave this facility. It is not bars. It is not barred up. It is a community within. It has a garden. They planted beautiful flowers. It has state-of-the-art screen TVs. Mm-hmm. The floor looks immaculate. And again, our work with the Henry County Sheriff's Office, this restorative center, is really to go in and provide instructional services. So our instructional services are five to six week modules or courses that we are actually teaching. We're teaching our friends there. We're teaching them. And so such that when they finish, they'll actually have a graduation. They'll be able to invite their friends and community and possible employment opportunities that will come as a result of this work and with the other partners that Director Carter stated.
What are some of the courses?
So we currently have, of course, I've shared with you, we have the welding program where we had three classes to graduate there. We're also onboarding logistics and distribution, given that we have a number of warehouses in our area. There has been an expressed interest in entrepreneurship. And of course, with those programs, they can continue at their local technical college post this experience. Mm-hmm. So, and we also have, of course, GED, first aid, AED, Lean Sigma 6, Yellow Belt has also been a part of that. And some of the additional classes, Fatherhood 101. And I'll tell you, that has been one of the most rewarding programs, because what we realize is that there is a boy inside, there is a man inside of every boy. But it's difficult for that man to manifest in the way he should, just as the flowers she spoke about. Mm-hmm. The reason why we have flowers out front, some flowers require more sunlight than others. Some require shade, but they must be in the right environment if they're going to thrive.
Let me ask you all this. Is there a process in place to maybe not want to use the word track, but make sure you all are checking in with folks and giving them a pathway if they are experiencing some difficulties, they can come back and say, hey, I need some help here in this area?
Absolutely. And I think we have several programs that are external of the agency that allows them that, whether it's Celebrate Recovery, whether it allows the mentorship program, whether it allows them to have a direct call to our office. Let's talk through it. And you'll be surprised of the number of calls that we have received, whether it's today is not a good day. Well, we need to redirect that energy, because I understand that we're sending them back to many times the same community in which they came from, which the same environment, the same elements that caused them to be there in the first place. So we're having to partner with that. What would you say to that, Dr. Howard? Because you all are tracking and monitoring at a different level.
Yeah. And so we're doing the same thing. We are tracking, and we also have what's called a life coach program. And our life coach program, we will actually connect our life coaches with some of the inmates or as they are released, so that we can track their information. We can continue to, we're thinking about how do we set up an email address, because some of these, they may have had email addresses, but then we may not want them connected to their old email addresses. So our life coaches are going to work with these individuals as they are released to make sure that they're getting the resources that they need, and that when those phone calls come, that they are a source of protection and safe space so that they will not recidivate. We know that statistically about 40 to 50% recidivate. We've got to reduce that. And how do we reduce that? By having these support systems, by having these mechanisms around individuals so that they don't feel like they're lonely. They don't feel like they don't have the resources or support. So they end up going back to a place where they feel most supported.
Is this a program also where folks, if they are entering the system, they can go ahead and say, depending on the charge or the offense, that perhaps they can go ahead and sign up and start receiving some of those resources? Or how do y'all determine who's eligible and who gets to sign up?
We're actually in conversations with our courts, because they're going to play a major, major role. And I want to just say thank you to the entire justice system of Henry County. They have walked with us through these processes. They have showed up to see what is this model about. They've invited additional conversations from every court level that, along with the solicitor, has been a part of the conversations. And that's going to be the key. They're not looking for just, let's put an individual away. They want to give them the resources. They want to give them the tools, although there is a process, because there's only so many individuals that you can take in a program like this.
How many can y'all take?
We can only take 80 at this point. But in that 80, when you think about cohorts of about 25 individuals at a time that's moving through that system in about 6 weeks, and I'll tell you, not everybody makes it out of that 6 weeks process. Because you must show up. We don't have homework, right? But we do have what is called focus work, where individuals are still required to turn in assignments. They must do the work in order to get the certifications or the certificate.
So right now you have 80?
As of right now, we're at around 54 as of noon today.
And mostly male?
Yes. We're in the process of launching the female portion as well. And so we'll have a dorm that'll be designated, and we'll begin that process with females also. So whenever I think about the justice involved, I don't just see men and women. I see fathers. I see mothers. I see sons. I see daughters.
As we begin to wrap up, when we started a segment and I talked about how Georgia was beginning to get some praise under former Governor Nathan Deal for how its entire criminal justice reform system and programs like this were a big part of that. If you had to reflect on the necessity for having more of these programs, and I could ask, how y'all being funded? Do you have enough money? But I think I know the answer to that. Dr. Howard, what would you want folks to know about the importance of having these type of programs in every county? And then maybe every county has something similar.
We absolutely must have programs like this. We have to have programs that help people before, during, and after. There are no questions. We know that there are some absolutely amazing individuals who make a wrong decision. Some of us, had it not been for grace, would have been behind the bars or could be behind the bars. And so we have to be really sensitive to understanding how do we continue to impact the lives of those who may not have already committed a crime so that we can help deter them, or those who have, and so we can help them. And so we have got to continue to think about how do we fund, how do we give alternative sentencing. And this is why it's so important that we're working with judges, not just in Henry County, but across the state, so that they can have pathways to alternative sentencing for individuals so that they can come through programs like the one at Morehouse School of Medicine, or like the one that we're doing with the Henry County. So yes, please, please, ma'am, please, sir, if you're listening, as you're listening, continue to advocate, continue to help us lobby for additional support, additional funding, so that we can impact the nation.
Director Carter, how much is all of this costing and where is it coming from?
So when I think to answer your question directly, when you look at leadership, when there is a vision in place, the vision will ultimately fund itself. Mm-hmm. And what do I mean by that? There are partners that have showed up. I can't tell you it's from one source. I can't tell you that it's from this source, this source, this source, because we have community partners mm-hmm. that have also engaged in this work. But what we know for certain is that it's better for us to reduce recidivism so that we don't have to fund the next set of situations based on them being in our custody.
But you would like more funding if it came from the state or federal level for this, correct?
Absolutely. And so I think that's definitely a given. But this is the part. It's going to depend upon leadership. If we did not have Sheriff Reginald B. Scandrett as the visionary, and this is near and dear to him based on his yesterday and his purpose for being the sheriff of Henry County, it wouldn't be a yes to this. We wouldn't know if someone else's passion mm-hmm. would be this. So he's committed not only to students, youth, but also those in which are in our care.
All right. To Marlon T. Carter, the director of the Henry County Sheriff's Office Restorative Center, and Dr. Angelita Howard, the founding assistant dean of the Online Education and Expanded Programs at the Morehouse School of Medicine, coming together for a program, a step in the right direction, Pathway Forward Reentry Program. Thank you both for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Thank you for what you're trying to do to help so many people.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Closer Look continues now from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. Last month, I spoke with Georgia's newly elected Commissioner of Labor, Bruce Thompson. We talked about a lot, including the need to modernize his agency's software system, the potential challenges of operating on a reduced budget, and efforts to change the image of the Georgia Department of Labor. And we also talked about proposed legislation that could impact the department.
You've been a part of the legislature. You know how all this works, but there are some bills that directly would affect your department. What are you concerned about with some of these measures? And have you spoken to these lawmakers? Are you in favor of them? There's I think three that are floating around here.
We'd have to talk about which one specifically, but we have three of our own bills.
There's the administrative assessment.
That's us.
Okay, so you like that one.
Well, it's because it's coming from our agency. And the administrative assessment, it's been around since the 80s. And what that does is it's an assessment or a fee that's charged on the amount from the employer that's paying in. So it doesn't raise the expense to the employer. It's just what's collected. There's a fee that's carved out to help fund us. And it sunsetted at the end of last year because it wasn't reauthorized because my predecessor
What's the fee for, again? Explain
how to fund us.
Okay.
Right. As you know, any funds that come in go into the General Assembly. It can't be designated, but this is money that is set aside that then, if it is authorized to us, helps fund us. So not necessarily just a carve out, but it's the state funding mechanism for us. But if this bill doesn't pass, right now the employers would be paying higher on the rate tables because that was a part of it as well. So we feel like it will pass.
Now, my next guest and his organization from the Georgia Budget Policy Institute, also known as GBPI, they don't have a position for or against this administrative assessment funding, but they do have concerns about House Bill 518 and Senate Bill 160. So join me now to talk more about this from the Georgia Budget Policy Institute is Senior Worker Justice Policy Analyst Ray Califani. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Rose. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we get into House Bill 518 and Senate Bill 160, just overall, your assessment on what's happening with the legislature this year in terms of those measures that you are paying close attention to as it relates to workforce and workforce development?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. I mean, you know, there's a lot of things going on, but I think, you know, in particular, when we think about what's happening with the unemployment insurance system, I'm going to give an analogy as far as like where we're
Yeah, because I wanted listeners to understand exactly what Georgia's Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund is all about.
Yes. So let's say, you know, your family designates you to take care of Family Emergency Trust Fund, right? And y'all come up with rules as far as how you do it, you know, what happens when money runs low, you know, all of that. And you agree to do that, right? And time goes on, you know, you get raises, you get promotions, you know, getting really good WABE money. And, you know, when it's time to be able to put, you know, money back into that fund to replenish it, and when things happen, you say, yeah, you know what, I want more of what I have, more of my money for me. You know, you come up with reasons, you change the rules as far as why, you know.
So I'm getting a bigger slice of the pie just because I feel like I should do it.
Right. You know, and as your slice, you know, as your, you know, own, you know, purse grows, you know, you still change the rules and say, hey, I'm not going to put as much in as I agreed to.
Now, I want to stop you there because someone listening says, okay, as this pie relates to the Department of Labor, who's funding, who's putting that money in?
Employers. So, you know, employers, you know, there have been agreements that have been made, you know, and this is something that's happened, you know, over the long term, you know, where, you know, employers make contributions into the trust fund.
Sure.
And the trust fund is where unemployment insurance benefits come from. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when people fall on hard times and no fault of their own, they depend on that trust fund to be able to fund the benefits to help them stay out of deep poverty, you know, all the hardships that come when you lose your job.
How is it calculated per business? And is it the same for maybe a Fortune 500 that's here in Georgia as opposed to a mom and pop bakery shop?
Beautiful question. I would say that, you know, the way that we structure how we finance our unemployment insurance trust fund, it puts an overloaded amount of burden on employers that pay low wages compared to those who have, you know, better wage jobs, who have more in the pocket.
That's you all's analysis.
Yes. Okay. I mean, and that's not simply our analysis.
Okay.
I mean, this is
you can look at the numbers and see that mom and pop bakery may be paying in terms of percentage
right.
a lot more than brand X that's located here in Georgia.
And yeah, in a sense. And I mean, it can get pretty deep in the weeds when you talk about like how that happens.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, ultimately, you know, where the level or threshold that you start with as far as like how much of an employer's payroll, how much, you know, contributions come out of an employer's payroll, it comes out of a very low percentage of their payroll, right? So those who don't have much of a payroll at all, or, you know, because they're making, they're a low wage employer, they're paying a lot more out of their payroll than somebody who's much bigger, you know, who has even, you know, higher wage jobs. So, you know, that's where that, you know, discrepancy or the inequity takes place when it comes to employers.
And the Department of Labor may say, well, listen, we need to make sure we have enough money in this fund. Let's go back to the Great Recession, 2008, I know, because I covered it, and we almost ran dry.
Absolutely.
Now, there was a lot of circumstances, obviously, because we were in a Great Recession.
Right.
But can you understand someone listening says, well, okay, but we need that money for, because you just said, for folks through no fault of theirs,
right,
following hard times, they need it. So what's your argument?
Well, we've got to actually prepare for that. We've got to prepare for the hard times. So let's go back to the Great Recession. During the Great Recession, during the years before that, you know, 2002, 2003, all the way up to 2007, we were not taking steps to prepare. What we were doing where we were suppressing employer contributions to the trust fund before the Great Recession even happened. So by the time, and that's on top of the poor ways that we financed the system already.
When you say suppressing, you mean that the calculations, the formula was a little weird, wacky?
When I say suppressing, you know, we're allowing them to pay a reduced rate from what was established before.
The big folks.
Right. Well, not just, I mean, it could be everybody,
okay,
in a sense. But, you know, all employers are paying a reduced rate from what it was before, from what it was established as before.
These measures, and you tell me which one, and I believe it's a Senate bill. Is it the Senate bill that concerns you the most about this?
Well, it's both. They're both almost identical. And I mean, you know, they're so close. I mean, you might as well call them the same when it comes to House Bill 518 and Senate Bill 160. But in essence, you know, they're creating this false dilemma. And the false dilemma is that we can only adequately fund that administrative assessment part that funds the Department of Labor's operations, but we can't adequately fund our trust fund at the same time. Mm-hmm. We're going to compensate for reestablishing an administrative assessment by reducing what we put into the trust fund. And that right there weakens the trust fund over the long term, mm-hmm, and puts us in a position where we're not as prepared for recessions as we should be.
In your analysis, and I know our listeners love numbers here, if you can. So with the administrative fee, which it needs to happen, employers,
yeah,
need to pay that.
Yeah.
How much money are we talking here? And then can you put that against then what's going into the insurance trust fund?
Well, I mean, I don't have an exact number, but I would, okay, certainly say millions. You know, we're talking about millions. Like, you know, the administrative assessment fee, at least from like 2016 up to 2022 before it sunsetted, you know, that brought about an average of $21 million to the Department of Labor for their administrative operation, mm-hmm, right? So, I mean, that's important for them. It's important for everybody. I mean, they certainly need to be able to take care of, you know, all the operations within their department to be able to function, no question. But when we think about, you know, putting that back in place and saying that it can only go back in place if we reduce the way we contribute to our trust fund, mm-hmm, we should not be putting them in competition. We can take care of both. And that's what we should be doing, not just taking care of, you know, what we need as far as the administration of a Department of Labor, but also making sure we're taking care of a trust fund that can prepare us for recessions in the future.
So then what is the process for that? Because for someone listening, and we want folks to understand, we're talking about there's a certain percentage of wages that you're saying paid by each employer. Hmm. Is that where you want to start? Or am I off base here?
Well, I mean, yes, absolutely. I mean, and that's starting just as far as like how we fundamentally, you know, fund our trust fund to make sure that it remains solvent and it's able to protect us when we go into recessions.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to, yeah, start there first. And there's a bunch of different ways we can do that.
Let's talk about one.
Well, let's just say an employer lays off a bunch of people that ends up, you know, having you're taking about $100,000 out of the trust fund, mm-hmm, right? And so they're responsible for $100,000 that came out of that trust fund. But as far as like what they have to pay back, what's being, you know, considered as far as, you know, what they're being responsible for as far as paying back, they're only considering $12,000 out of that $100,000 that came out of the trust fund that took place when they laid folks off.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you're only being held accountable for $12,000 of the $100,000 that you had coming out of that trust fund because you had layoffs that, mm-hmm, that led to people getting benefits that pulled out of that trust,
yeah,
fund, then that right there is one way that you're poorly financing a trust fund, right? So it's that and a number of other ways that we can start. And then we can say think about making sure we're not suppressing fund contributions either.
What are other states doing? Is this a similar model? Is there a state out there? And I always like to ask this question for folks like you, because for our listeners, because we throw a lot of numbers at them, and sometimes it's easier to say, okay, well, let's look at this state that might be comparable to Georgia in terms of population, that is maybe funding their insurance trust in a way that we should be.
Yeah. Well, I'll start by saying, just in comparison to other states, like with all the things that go into deciding how much each employer contributes to a fund, the average the average contributions that employers in Georgia make compared to all other states, we're below like 30 other states when it comes to that.
30.
But when you also think about, what I talked about when I was trying to make this analogy, hey, okay, Rose, you're getting, promotions, more money, you're getting really good WABE money. Georgia,
I like how you say that, getting really good WABE
money. Yeah, Georgia is, it's, corporate profits are growing and growing and growing. And when you think about how things have taken place over decades, right, businesses are doing better and better and better, but yet we're still at a certain very, very low threshold that we were in really back in the 80s as far as how much we're requiring them to put in to contribute.
So it sounds also to me, and you correct me if I'm wrong, this is a preventive measure also changing this formula, because in case we know we're going to hit a recession, may not be a great recession like back in 2008, but it's a preparation and a preventive measure as well too, so we don't end up like we did back in 2008.
Right. And just to give another number. So, when you think about how much the federal government says that states, should be prepared when it comes to as far as how much they should have in their trust fund to be able to handle the average recession. Right. Mm-hmm. States should have at least a year's worth of funding in their trust fund to be able to handle the average recession that takes place.
Well, I want to back up for a moment, because to be fair, also, every state, including Georgia, is also coming off this thing that's still around called the pandemic.
Right.
So they've paid out. And I know there were some federal funds that came into that as well.
Absolutely.
And now we're recovering. I don't know if we've recovered, but we're recovering from that.
Right.
So can you understand someone saying, well, that's maybe not fair to not saying you're picking on them, to say it needs to change now because we still are dealing with the effects of a pandemic here and no one knew how to prepare for that. Can we take a year or two to see if let's say this bill passes and see what happens? Or,
well, see, and that's like that type of approach. Like, okay, let's just do this and see what happens in a
That's why I'm not the labor commissioner, obviously.
Before the Great Recession happened in 2002, we said, let's suppress contributions to the trust fund and we'll just come back to it. We got other things we have to do. We did that same thing in 2003. We did it again in 2004. We did it again in 2005. We did it every year all the way up to 2007, saying, hey, let's just reduce our contributions to the trust fund now, because of other priorities. And then, we'll see what happens. Great Recession hit. We weren't prepared.
Yeah.
And we went insolvent. Every state didn't go insolvent. Every state's trust fund did not go insolvent during the Great Recession because they had better ways of financing their trust fund going into it. And that's the same type of approach we have to be best prepared when recessions come. And one thing we know for certain, the Federal Reserve has said, they're willing to put, our country into a recession to be able to fight inflation down. So, we've got to be prepared for emergencies when they happen. And when we take steps not to, we put ourselves at risk.
I understand that you reached out to Georgia's Labor Commissioner, Bruce Thompson. Have you had an opportunity to speak with him?
Well, I mean,
and his folks about this?
I mean, we've had a brief conversation just about, where he stands on it and where we do. And we're certainly, we don't have any issue with, administrative, reestablishing an administrative assessment.
That's fine.
That is perfectly fine.
You're talking about the insurance fund.
Right.
Which is that safety net.
Right. Our issue, GBPI's issue, is that they should not be in competition. Their funding, the way we take care of them, should not be in competition. We should not, the way we take care of the folks that work in the Department of Labor and all their, administrative needs, we have the same priorities that we give to our trust fund because that's the core of the unemployment insurance system altogether. If you don't have a healthy trust fund, you don't have a healthy unemployment insurance system that people can rely on.
Are you saying that Georgia's right now that our trust fund is it unhealthy? Is that your assessment?
Well, I would say that I just give you a number. like as I said earlier that the federal government said they recommend that you have at least a year's worth of money to be able to handle.
Do
the
you know how much
recession.
We have?
We have 4 months worth to handle the average recession right now. So if you're taking away contributions to the trust fund, if you're suppressing them, reducing them for 3 years, when we need to build it back up to be ready for the next one, that's not a good mm-hmm. practice because that puts us at further risk of falling into insolvency in a future recession.
Have you talked then to those lawmakers that are pushing this, that have backed this? Often you all might show up at committee meeting hearings.
Yeah. I mean, I've showed up at some, you know, I don't know how much I've been welcome or not welcome. But, you know, at the same time, you know, I've certainly, you know, expressed, you know, our stances on it and just let lawmakers know that, hey, there's a better way to do this. We don't need to create this false dilemma mm-hmm. that we can fund one adequately and not fund the other adequately, or we can fund one and then put the other one at risk. We need to take care of both because we have to make prudent decisions to be able to prepare for future recessions.
The first quarter of this year, so many analysts talked about this is the metric that we use. We'll look at how, you know, the economy is faring and then might give an indication when this recession. Well, let me ask you, are we going to a recession? You believe, you agree? Because every week it changes depending on who you ask.
I mean, you know,
we're dealing with inflation.
That's a great question. I'll say this. Broadly, you know, the broad numbers say, you know, we're still doing good. But let's just talk about what it looks like for black workers, right? So right now, our overall unemployment rate is 3.1. For black workers, it's 5.6. Mm-hmm. So you can say black workers are experiencing a recession now. And the way that our unemployment insurance system is set up now, it makes it, you know, very difficult to, for most people, not just black workers, but for most people to be able to access.
For low-wage earners especially, too.
Yeah, I mean, another number, 2 out of 10 unemployed workers in Georgia are actually involuntary unemployed, mm-hmm. unemployed people in Georgia are actually receiving unemployment insurance. Just 2 out of 10.
Wow. We'll see what happens. From the GBPI, Senior Worker Justice Policy Analyst Ray Califani, thank you so much for coming in and taking the time. We'll keep an eye on these measures.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
And that's it for this edition of Closer Look. Our producers are LaShawn Hudson and Daniel Razel. Tiffany Griffith is our supervising producer. Our engineer is Sawyer Vanderwerth. If you missed any of today's program, it's online, wabe.org/closerlook. And of course, Closer Look weeknights at 7 p.m. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE from Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WABE politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WABE politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WABE.org or your favorite podcast platform.